Welcome back to the Extra Inning Postgame Show with Bill Lasky. Got a great guest today, a good friend of mine. He was an American League All-Star in 1988 with the Oakland A's, and now, of course, a World Series champion in 1989 when they beat the San Francisco Giants. What I love about this, an American League batting champ in 1981 with the Boston Red Sox. Three consecutive AL pennants with the Oakland A's. I got more to throw at you, but let's bring Carney Lansford. Carney, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Bill. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. Thank you for joining me today. Of course, the 2023 spring training is getting over. It's pretty much done now, and we're moving on to the season. You played 15 years in Major League Baseball. What were some of the checkpoints that you went through for yourself as spring training ended and you started looking into going into that opening day?
You know, Bill, every spring was different for me. One year I'd end spring training ready to go. And then there were times where I felt like, you know, I wish I had another week to get my timing down. But it always seemed to work out. You have those little jitters. I don't care how many years you played. You know, I just always had the jitters before the first game. So I just wanted to make sure that I was ready when the season started.
You know, Carney, you ended up with a .290 lifetime batting average. And I always thought you were one of the best contact hitters. You hit with power. You hit gaps. When you went into spring training, did you do a lot of batting practice against machines? Did you like doing that, or did you like live BP? What were some of the things that you got ready for?
You know, Bill, for me, when I was with the Angels, the first 3 years of my career, nobody ever really worked with me. You know, we had a lot of veterans. I was the only young player on that team. So when I got traded to Boston, a guy named Walt Reiniak was my hitting coach there. And he got me into soft toss. And from then on, every year, all year before, almost every game, I would do soft toss in a cage, whether at home or on the road, just to get myself prepared for the game.
You know, as a pitcher, you know, we go through dead arm syndrome. We do have a couple little outings where you struggle. But, you know, when I look at hitters and I look at hitters coming into a season, don't you want to have a kind of a momentum going into the season? Because some of the guys I look at batting 100, 150, to me, as a pitcher now, you're a hitter. Don't you want to have some stability in getting in that batter's box with some kind of success?
100%. You know, the couple of the best years I had with the A's, our pitching coach was Ron Shuler. And he threw this great curveball that I used to love to hit. And if I felt like my timing was off a little bit, he would stay on a day that I had off in spring training. He would stay back and throw to me for about a half an hour. And he would throw half of them curveballs, half of them fastballs. And he would mix in every other one was a curveball or whatever. I can't tell you how much that helped get my timing. I just got locked in with him. So things like that, yeah, absolutely. You want to be locked in when that first pitch is thrown to you once the season starts.
You know, Carney, you had a short approach. You always had your hands back. You always pushed the ball to the opposite way. That was one thing that I loved watching you hit. You loved that ball in. You could drive it out to left field. But that ball away, you seemed to wait for that ball to come in a little bit more, and then you were approached to right field. How did you learn to do that, and how successful in your mindset when you went into the box that you could go away that way and you could go in and pound the ball that way?
Well, you know, I always wanted to have the entire plate covered. That's the main thing with soft toss. And again, when I got to Boston and I won that batting title there my first year there, it was because Walt Reiniak taught me about soft toss. And the good thing about soft toss is you can put the ball where you want it if you're the guy tossing. So he would cover the entire plate. So, you know, when game time started, I felt like I had that plate covered. You know, I didn't learn to really consistently hit the ball to right field, right center, until I went to Boston. So, you know, if I hit the ball to right when I was with the Angels, it was probably an accident. It's true.
I don't believe that, Carney, because there was no accident when you got in the box. Your mindset was exactly the way you hit, and you hit like a machine for many, many years. Let's go to the defensive side. When you played third base, did you have a long glove, a short glove? What were some of the diameters of the glove you used all the time?
You know, from the time I was in high school, I was a shortstop in high school, but, you know, I had pretty good-sized hands, so I had to have a little bigger glove. So I always used a Wilson A2000. Mm, okay. And, yeah, you know, let me tell you, I can't tell you how many times at third base, because it's such a reaction position most of the time, that how many line drives I took and one hoppers I took from people with the ball at the very end of the glove. So I wouldn't have changed anything. I know a lot of guys use a smaller glove, a Rawlings glove or whatever, but for me, it was just I felt comfortable with that little bit, inch or two more on the end of the glove.
So the question is, did you use the same glove for 15 years? Did you change and do new gloves every spring? Did you break in new gloves, or did you kind of just form fit that same glove that was your gamer?
You know, Bill, I had a contract with Wilson. So in spring training, they'd always give me like three gloves.
Right.
And I would go through two of them in a season. So I always said break in the one during BP. So it was ready to go in case, you know, something happened to the other glove. Most of the time, they just got worn out. Just to the leather got too thin, so I'd have to replace them.
Now, going back to the mental side of being a defensive player at hot corner at third base, same thing I go back to, spring training. Take a lot of ground balls, repetition. What did you like to do? And especially with that little ball that came in where you had to barehand it, how many of those did you practice?
Oh, 1 year after my rookie year, with the Angels, they sent me to instructional league just to get up in the mornings and go field. Well, two things: go field slow rollers, and work on bunting, because I hit second when I first came up with the Angels, and Jim Fregosi wanted me to be able to bunt guys over and stuff like that. So I would get up, go every day to instructional league, do those two things, and then go back to the hotel. When I got to Oakland, Cleet Boyer was the third base coach there. He's one of the greatest third basemen ever. And I went to spring training early my second year there, I think it was 84, and just to work with him. And what he did was he got me, if you remember, I got really crouched at third base. Mm-hmm. And he had me do that, and we did that every day for a while. And it's almost like, you know, your inside of your legs get sore because you're crouching like a catcher. once you got that over that soreness or whatever, it was just natural. And it actually, I loved it because it helped me see the ground ball so much better because my eyes were closer to the ball. So that's kind of why I did that.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Null. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just been handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.
Well, Carney, one of the things I always loved watching you play third base was the offense of the off-balance throw. And some of the times coming off where you had to just throw off your right foot and your left foot's in midair and you're throwing sideways. But you were so accurate about that. Is that something else that you worked at? And the other question with this, how did you work on balance? Because that's so difficult.
Well, you know, talking about the off-balance throw, I mean, that's just something you have to work on. And for me, you know, having for most of my career, having Mark McGwire over at first base, who was a really underrated first baseman, he saved me so many errors. But I would work on throwing the ball, starting it, because I would start it to his right because it would come back to him. So I had a little sink on the ball when I throw, you know, you're throwing either underhanded or sidearm. And so you just have to work on that angle and where you need to start the ball off with those off-balance throws. So, yeah, I would work on those every day. Balls right at me, balls to my left, balls to my right, slow rollers. I mean, you just have to be ready to handle all those balls. And, you know, the bare hand thing for me was tough because there's some guys that are really limber and able to get down easy like that. That wasn't an easy play for me. I had to most of the time field those balls with my glove and still try to get the guy out of first base.
Well, and the other thing, too, you had thick legs. That was another thing. You had strong legs, and I remember that. And that had to have some kind of difficulty, too, in trying to bend over to one-handed or to try to scoop it up with your right hand. Those plays always seemed to me as a third baseman, those were the ones that made that play, the good third baseman. Do you agree?
Absolutely. You know, be honest with you, I was jealous of some of those guys that could do that. You know, that could bend over and bare hand those balls like that so easily. You know, that guy that came after me, Scott Brosius, and I think Eric Chavez was really great at that too. But I just didn't have that kind of body where it felt natural to do that. So,
well, let's go back in your time. You grew up in Santa Clara. Well, you had brothers who hung out with you all the time. Was baseball your first love, or was there other sports?
You know, I had four brothers. And back in the day, you know, we didn't have video games and all that stuff. So we would play wiffle ball in our backyard or in our front yard. We'd play football out in the street. We'd throw the ball up in, you know, the light poles at night and practice catching pop-ups and stuff like that. And then we would go to the high school, which is only a couple blocks away, and we'd play slow-pitch baseball. So, you know, I actually, in high school, I probably enjoyed football and basketball more than baseball. I think I was just better at baseball.
Well, I got to go back a little farther than before we get into high school. And I love this story. It ends up in Williamsport, Pennsylvania at the Little League World Series. You brought a team in from Santa Clara and you made it all the way to the finals. Those memories right there had to get you started into the love of baseball.
Absolutely. We had a blast doing that. Of course, when you're 12 years old, you don't realize what you're accomplishing. And remember, back then, that was before the double elimination thing. So if you lost one game, you were out, period. Mm-hmm. So we were actually able to make it to the championship game and end up being the first team to lose to Taiwan. But we had a blast. And, you know, it took a few years, 2 or 3 years after that, until I realized exactly what we did accomplish there. So, and then, you know, Major League Baseball, years after, had the 50th anniversary of Little League Baseball, and they flew myself, my wife, and my kids in for a celebration of that. So that my kids got to see that Williamsport and the stadiums and stuff there, and they have a Little League Hall of Fame thing there. It was really cool. We enjoyed that.
Cardi Lansford joining me on Extra Innings. Let's move on to Wilcox High School, because I tell you what, you had a great career at Wilcox. Matter of fact, the baseball diamonds got your name on it. They named the field after you. Once you moved into high school, like you said, you played multiple sports, and baseball was love. You really attracted to it, and you really, really opened a lot of eyes. And right then and there, I think that was the first start where I think the competitive juices of Cardi Lansford started flowing, and you started seeing a vision of possibly a professional player.
Yeah, you know, Bill, actually, when we went to Williamsport, and, you know, I think that's when I first set in that, you know, I want to be a major league player someday. And then when I got in high school, you know, as you grow, you get stronger, bigger, whatever, your arm strength gets better, your power gets better hitting and stuff. I really enjoyed the competitiveness of it. You know, it's just that as a pitcher, that one-on-one competition between yourself and the pitcher, I just don't think that can be beat. So I just fell in love with it then, and I was just determined to do what it would take to get to the big leagues.
Well, and you sure and certainly did. At age 21, 1978, you stepped in the box with the California Angels and made your big league career start at that time. Do you remember your major league debut? Do you remember the pitcher you faced at your first at the bat?
You know, I don't remember who the pitcher was. It was a right-handed reliever with the A's, and I flew out to right field my first at bat. But, you know, ironically, I didn't start when I first came up. It took me, 10 days or 2 weeks, only because our third baseman, Dave Trott, got hurt. And so I started against the A's in Oakland. And I actually got my first big league hit against the Oakland A's.
That's great.
It was pretty cool.
Well, you know, some of the things I look at, and I love doing this and researching players and researching what you did with the bat in your hands. And I knew you. I watched you across the bay when I was with the Giants in the early 80s. You were with the A's. But one thing you never did, and this is something I can always tell you didn't strike out much. You always put the ball in play. And, again, I'm looking at numbers again. Your first year, 500 plate appearances, you struck out 67 times. That's your rookie year. And to me, the mindset has to be you're going to hit the ball, you're going to make contact, you're going to find a hole. How did you do that so successful for so many years?
You know, again, Bill, it goes back to when I went to Boston. My rookie year, I didn't strike out a lot, but the next year I had like 650 plate appearances,
yeah,
official plate appearances, and I struck out over 100 times. But I had, you know, I still hit like 287 or something like that with 19 home runs or so. But when I went to Boston, that's when I really cut down my strikeouts. If I struck out more than 1 out of 10 times, that was not good. I mean, I just felt like putting the ball in play, you give yourself a chance for something good to happen. I mean, if you strike out, you don't even have a chance. You know, you put a ball in play, it can take a bad hop. You can get a swinging bunt type thing. You can bloop a ball in. But if you don't put the ball in play, you got no chance. So Walt Reniac is really the guy that taught me how to do that.
And I tell you what, Carney, your first year in Boston hit 336, and the numbers just are falling off the plate here. You know, everything you dialed in there, from walks at 34, only striking out 28 times. And did you hit second most of the time in the order, or did you hit third? Because you were right at the top of the order most of the time, wasn't it?
No, actually, I think with Boston, I hit like fifth most of the year. Because we had Jerry Remy leading off. We had Dwight Evans, who hit second, and then Jim Rice, who hit third.
Not bad.
And then we had Yaz. Yaz was still playing. He was at the end of his career, so I didn't hit before Carl Yastrzemski.
But I tell you what, when you look at the couple of years you played there, both years hit over 300, of course. You won a batting award in 81. First right-handed player to do that in 11 years. And that has to say something about your approach to hitting, your approach to your eyesight to the ball. And these are questions I love to ask hitters. You know, did you do stuff in the cage or maybe on the tee to make your eyes focus a little better?
You know, Bill, you hear stories, you know, I used to hear stories about Tiger Woods and guys like Michael Jordan, guys that could slow the game down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that year, I did that more than any other year in my career. I think it's because I started the soft toss thing then. But literally, there were a number of times where I'd walk up to the plate and I'd look and see where everybody in the infield is playing. And then I'd just say, you know what? I'm just going to hit a ball right back up the middle. And I was able to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of my career, I wasn't able to do that. But, I mean, that's the biggest thing to me that comes back to me is I was able to slow the game down and actually be able to do stuff like that.
Well, also in 1981, when you hit 336, you had 104 singles, and that was the second most in Major League Baseball. And that just tells me exactly what you just said. You find the hole, you look where it is, and, of course, every hitter tried to knock the cover off the ball right back at the pitcher. Was there a pitch back then that you remembered? Was it an off-speed pitch that kind of got you off balance? Or was there one thing that you watched in every pitcher that you said, oh, he's using his pitch a little bit more at different times?
You know, there were little things, I think, Bill, that that year, again, slowing things down. I mean, I would see the pitcher. I remember like it was yesterday facing this pitcher, and I can't remember who it was, but he was a right-handed pitcher, and he told his shortstop to move in, you know, up towards the middle or whatever. I'm like, oh, to move in the hole. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, he's going to throw me something off speed here. He, you know, that's why he wants this guy in the hole. So I kind of sat on a curveball, and I lined it into left field for an RBI, but it was because the pitcher told me basically what he was going to throw.
Yeah, so, that's true.
And then I remember facing Mike Norris in Boston, and he's a big screwball guy, and I would sit on his screwball and get base hits off him.
That's awesome.
You know, when you're swinging and you're that confident, those things happen.
You know, and I tell you, I was a pitcher. Tendencies you go to, you know, the breaking ball at certain times, the sinker at certain times, the tendencies that pitchers do, if hitters can see that. And with all the analytics they're throwing now, that should be a testimony for the hitter to learn.
You know, Bill, when we have hitters meetings, we'd always have them, in Antonio Russo's office when he was our manager. And we would go over the starting pitcher and a couple of the bullpen guys. And I would always say, myself and Dave Henderson would say, I want to know what he's got, but I want to know in a big situation what his out pitch is and what he's going to try and get me out with. That's what I want to know. And, everybody has a fastball, but, when the game's on the line and he needs to get me out, what's his pitch going to be? And that's what I needed to know. That's all.
Now, let me go with this. Did you define, I want a breaking ball? I think when he's 2-2, he goes to breaking ball more. This is what I'm saying, the repetition of the mind of the pitcher. You're trying to figure out at different times of the count, different times if there's men on base, what they throw, correct?
Yeah, because of soft toss and so forth, I was always, even in high school, I was always a good curveball hitting guy. Mm-hmm. And so, we were playing Detroit one time when Big Lance Parrish was behind the plate catching. And he called a curveball, and halfway to the plate, he goes, "Oh, no." And boom, I hit it for a home run. He's like, you could just tell, And even Pat Corrales, when he was the manager of the Cleveland Indians, he would get really upset at his pitchers when he was in the dugout. Obviously, he wasn't calling the pitches, but when they'd throw me a curveball, he did not like that. He just didn't like it. And because I handled the curveball well. And that was, as a hitter, that's what shortens a lot of careers. If you can't hit a breaking ball,
you're right.
You either learn how to do that or you're gone.
And let me tell you, a tendency from a pitcher's mind, if I see it and you can't hit it, I'm going to continue to throw it until you can. And most of the time, that's where a lot of the mistakes happen with hitters. They're looking fastball and, hey, I'm going to throw you three sliders if you can't hit a slider. But I've always liked to get in your mind because you are one of the best hitters I've always watched and remember. And let's go to Oakland A's. You get traded to Oakland A's. Of course, Wade Boggs comes to Boston. No room for Hart Carney. So you move to Oakland A's. But this is when your career really took off in 1983. How did you like that trade? And what did you think about coming home?
I loved the trade because, my wife and I were on vacation in Hawaii, and the winter meetings were on a different island in Hawaii at that time. And so my agent, Jerry Capstein, by the way, we requested a trade from Boston. They weren't going to pay anybody but Dwight Evans and Jim Rice at that time, nobody else. So we requested a trade, and we're in Hawaii, and I get a call from my agent, Jerry Capstein, and he's like, "Well, it looks like it's going to come down to the New York Yankees or the Oakland A's." And my wife and I were praying it was going to be Oakland because we're going back home. We're both from the Bay Area, and I couldn't stand New York. I could not stand going to New York. That's the one place. The only thing I liked about going there was leaving there. We got a call about an hour later, and we'd been traded to Oakland, and we were ecstatic. And so being able to play there as a player the next 10 years was awesome.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
And when you come to Oakland, Tony La Russa was the manager, I presume. I don't remember the factual, but I'm pretty sure he was the manager. And you fit right in with this team because there was some power hitters. You had good defense on that side. What did you like about the Oakland A's when you first came over?
Well, honestly, when I first got there, Tony didn't come there until like 86, I think it was.
Okay.
Steve Boros was the manager. He just signed there from Kansas City as a coach. Anyways, I liked the guys. There was great chemistry on the team. Dwayne Murphy, Michael Davis, Mike Heath was our catcher at the time. Tony Phillips was there. Ricky was there. And then Jackie Moore took over for Steve Boros. And then when Tony came in 86, it might have been during the season in 86, everything just clicked because he was such a great manager. I mean, he knew how to fire the guys up. He was great as far as handling a pitching staff. He liked to be very aggressive, and he didn't tolerate if you didn't give 110% every game. So he always would say, I don't care if you don't have 100% today, but I want 100% of whatever you got.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you knew you were going to be in trouble.
And you know, and that's what you want, don't
playing.
You?
Absolutely.
That's what you want out of your manager. That's what you want. You want them to care for you, and you want to give him the best. And I've heard nothing great, you know, all great things about Tony La Russa as a manager to fire up the troops, as well as you're sticking up for him too.
Absolutely. And you know what? When I started playing anyway, Joe Rudy was my teammate in Boston for a year or two in Oakland. And we both lived in Baker City, Oregon, a small town, northeastern Oregon. And I would go to his ranch. He had a beautiful ranch. And I would go in his family room, and he had 3 world champion trophies that I had to look at all the time. And I'm like, I want one of those so bad. So, I mean, what I was going to do, whatever it took. And once we got Tony there and we acquired guys like Bobby Welch and Rick Honeycutt and mm-hmm. Dave Parker, and those young guys came up for us, Canseco, then McGuire, then Walt Weiss, Jerry Steinbach. I mean, we had all the pieces, though. We had every piece that you needed to win a world championship. We had a great bullpen. We had great, you know, starting pitchers, Dave Stewart, Bobby Welch, Mike Moore, Kurt Young. And we had every piece. So even when Tony would give some of the starters a day off, our guys that went out and played, we didn't really drop off any. Maybe a little, but not much, because we had really good backup players.
Now, when you went in that lineup, where did you hit? You hit up a top, right? You were second most of the time?
Most of the time I hit second. Every once in a while, Tony would move us around. I mean, if I was struggling some, he sometimes would move me down to sixth or something. But then, you know, if I started swinging the bat good again, it'd be right back up to second. So, it's a challenge. I got to tell you, it's a challenge hitting second behind the greatest leadoff hitter ever, Ricky Henderson. And I mean, you know, you have to take pitches so they give him an opportunity to steal, and then you have to give your bat up by moving him over to third base so many times. So, you know, 1989 I consider my best year, because I was hitting behind him the entire year, and I hit .336 just like I did in Boston when I won the batting title. But unfortunately for me, Kirby Puckett ended up winning the batting title. He hit like .340 or something like that. So it actually came down to the very last day of the season against the Kansas City Royals. And it was an interesting story, because they're supposed to start right-handed pitcher against this veteran guy that I had faced many a time and felt pretty comfortable against. But right 10 minutes before the game started, they switched starting pitchers and started this rookie guy who I never heard of. And he came out and absolutely dealt against us. And I went 0-for-3 with a walk and was happy to get the walk. And then Kirby was up in Seattle and got a couple hits to win the batting side. But the good thing is, that's the year we won the world championship.
You sure did. Carney Lance, for joining me for a few more minutes on extra innings. Some stat that I looked at here that I was kind of surprised at, and that's stolen bases from Carney Lansford. And let me tell you, man, you're talking about 87, 88, 89, 27 stolen in 87, 29 in 88, 89, you had 37. You had 224 stolen bags in your career. Tell me about that speed you had, Carney.
Well, you know, that was one of the things, really, that I had my entire life. I was able to run, and that's what actually opened up a lot of people's eyes, was the fact that I could run, especially from the right-hand side. So when Tony actually took over in 86, he came up to me one day and said, "Do you think you can steal some bases?" I said, "Tony, if you let me pick the pitch to go on, I'll steal bases." He goes, "Okay, well, you have the green light unless I give you the red light. You have the green light to pick your pitch." And so, you know, a lot of times I would go when I felt like it was a breaking ball situation or a changeup situation or whatever. But, you know, I just felt like, here's a guy that's finally going to let me be on my own. And that's when I started stealing bases. So, you know, that was a tool in my back pocket that I hadn't really been given the opportunity to use. So it was nice. He gave me freedom on the bases. And, you know, as a player, when you're an everyday player, that's the most fun, is when you're on base and you get to run the bases. So I liked it. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, let me tell you, that was a surprise. I did not know that. And I tell you what, when you're seeing those numbers with 224 stolen bags, you did get some good jumps, and you definitely were successful. One of the things I looked at here, Carney, Did you change your stance at times? Did you step on top of the plate a little bit more at different times and a different type of the counts? Because you were hit by pitch a lot. And matter of fact, in 1989, you were second in the AL by getting drilled.
Well, I'll tell you what, because, you know, there are guys like Ricky who would love to style on guys.
Times, took it out on you.
They would take that out on me. So, you know, and plus, I think, you know, there was a thing that if we're going to get this guy out, we got to bust him in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, can't let him get extended or whatever. And you know how that goes as a pitcher, you know. But and I had the outside part of the plate covered. And so, you know, I mean, it wasn't intentional all the time, but I know for a fact there were times where I got thrown out intentionally. So that's just part of the game, though.
And it was, but, you know, the same thing, you know, what's the count? Where am I going to go? Is Ricky running? I mean, those are all things that come into attack. Did you use the same length and ounce bats? Did you change with the direction of the pitcher coming out, or did you use the same model at all times?
You know what? I used the same bat, the same size bat, the first half of the season. And then when the dog days of August rolled around, I would drop down an ounce. And maybe half an inch with the bat. So, yeah, I did change. When I felt like my body was starting to get a little tired, I'd change my bat.
What was your length and ounce that you used, Carney?
You know, I started off the season with a 34.5, 33-ounce bat. And then I dropped down to like a 34, 32
that's cool.
In August. So,
did you get the nice grains where they were like an inch to 2 inches apart, not like us pitchers that got them right next to each other?
You know what? When you win a batting title, you start getting those
exactly.
So, yeah, we had a lot of guys that started getting, I mean, you make an all-star team, you start getting, you know, the best gloves and the best bats.
Of course. Hey, last thing, you know, you got the Hutch Award, and this was Fred Hutchinson. You got this award, yes, in 1992. It exemplifies a lot of things on and off the field. Tell us a little bit about that award and what it means to you.
I tell you, it's a heck of an honor. You know, it's this award, which I didn't even hear about it until I actually received this award. They do a lot of great things. They've raised a ton of money for cancer. And, that was one of the most proud achievements for me, was to win that comeback player award from the Hutchins thing. So, you know, I still get emails every year from the Hutchinsons cancer thing. So, yeah, of all the things I did, to win that award was unbelievable to me.
Yeah, I tell you what, there's some great, great players that have won this award, and you're part of it, 1992. But, Carney Philanser, it's always great catching up with you, my friend, and it's always love talking baseball with you. And, again, I appreciate your time today.
Bill, it's my pleasure. And like you said, for me, the same goes. I love talking baseball with you. Just love talking to you anytime.
Yep, great. That was a great Carney Lansford on Extra Innings Postgame Show. More coming up here, right here on KNBR, the Sports Leader.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.